your hopes and dreams and help you work towards them as your financial partner. Happy holidays from your friends at Merchants Bank.
National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, December 15th, and you've joined us for this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Every Wednesday at 9 a.m., we get together here on KYMN Radio to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore these challenges. So throughout this year, we've been looking at nuclear strategy, advanced nuclear weapons delivery capabilities, and the effect of these new technologies on nuclear deterrence. We've also looked a bit at nuclear treaties and the implications of those treaties on American national security interests. We'll continue those discussions today, but with a greater focus on the subject of nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament. Our guest today is Dr. David Cooper. David Cooper holds a tenured faculty appointment as the James V. Forrestal Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He previously served as chair of the Department of National Security Affairs from 2010 to 2018. He teaches in the Naval War College's core and elective programs, and his areas of expertise include nonproliferation, arms control and disarmament, weapons of mass destruction, multilateral negotiations and organizations, international relations theory, and U.S. foreign policy. David Cooper is a scholar practitioner who served for almost two decades in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he held a career appointment in the senior executive service, including at the two-star level equivalent. Dr. Cooper completed his undergraduate education at Oberlin College, earned a master's degree in international affairs from Columbia, and completed his doctorate at the Australian National University in Canberra, Australia. Dr. Cooper, welcome to National Security This Week.
John, thanks very much. Great to be here.
So you are on, I assume, a semester or break from the War College right now. Is that right?
No. We are proceeding ahead. I am just taking time to do this. We value doing this kind of outreach and making sure that what we do is getting out there and helping the discourse on national security overall.
And speaking of that, I should highlight for our audience that as we have our discussion today, the views that you express are your own, and it's not the official public position of the Naval War College or the United States Navy. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Just me, not representing anyone else, no institution. That way I can give whatever opinion is on my mind without okay. worrying about it.
Fair enough. So let's start our show today with the fact that you were a scholar practitioner on these issues of national security. You held various positions in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, or OSD as we call it, over the course of about two decades. Can you tell us a little bit about the positions you held and the responsibilities you had in some of those positions? I'm certain people listening to our show would like to know a little bit more about the civilian career paths inside the Pentagon.
Sure. I'm kind of a strange bird in that I grew up in the Pentagon, as it were, and had a first career as a career Defense Department policy official, and then transitioned to a second career in academia about 12 years ago. And that's a pretty rare transition to make. There aren't many people in academia with extensive policy background. But to your question, I came into the Pentagon on a program called the Presidential Management Fellowship Program, which is a great program. It's actually not DOD. It's government-wide, run out of the Office of Personnel Management. And it is designed basically to be a management fast-track program for people coming out of top public policy master's degree programs. So it's a two-year program, and at the end of that, I became what's called an action officer, also known as a desk officer. That's kind of the people who have portfolios for a specific issue. For example, I was my first job was doing regional security negotiations. So I was doing negotiations in Europe, in the Middle East, in Latin America, multilateral regional security negotiations. Then I moved over and became the portfolio manager for missile nonproliferation. And After that, did that for a number of years, briefly worked on biological weapons convention negotiations. Then I got promoted and became the deputy director. And after that, the director of the Office of Strategic Arms Control Policy. So that, between the United States and Russia, although a number of nuclear treaties. From there, I became the director of nonproliferation policy, where I was responsible for the panoply of efforts to combat the spread of weapons of mass destruction. I served briefly as the principal director of Homeland Security Integration, where I was responsible for marrying up the Department of Defense, Homeland Defense efforts with the Department of Homeland Security, which at the time, in the late 2000s, was still a relatively new entity. And then finally, my last assignment before resigning from the SES in order to move into academia was as what's called the J9, which the technical term or title is Director of Outreach. At the then brand new U.S. AFRICOM, where I also was the director of strategic communication. So I was co-hatted, dual-hatted on that one. And that was the two-star level position where I was one of six what's called joint staff directors reporting directly to the AFRICOM commander.
So you've had quite a variety of experiences in the national security arena, clearly throughout that career. So, David,
one thing I should say just very briefly is a lot of people, you know, I get that question and they're like, wow, but, you know, you've done all those things. What an unusual career path. And I must say that within the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, OSD Policy, as we call it, very typical career path. I mean, you know, most of the career officials who stay for that period of time, you know, a lot of younger people come in, do it for 5 or 6 or 7 years, and then move out to go to think tanks or industry or over to Congress or whatnot. But for those who stay, it's actually a pretty typical career path. You typically get to more senior levels and they throw you into doing a lot of different things, and it's all different, but it's all very interesting and all pretty important.
So one of the areas that DOD is clearly concerned about in protecting American national security is this issue of proliferation, and you spent a good bit of your DOD career doing that, especially for weapons of mass destruction. So I was a career intelligence officer in the Navy, and I had the opportunity to take a lot of intelligence courses on weapons of mass destruction, did a lot of analytical work related to it, operational work related to it. I came to my own conclusions about which was the most worrisome amongst nuclear, chemical, and biological threats. As you've clearly looked at these issues during your career in government and now in academia at the U.S. Naval War College, how would you rank these three threats and why?
Well, the ranking is pretty easy. One, nuclear. Two, biological, and a very, very, very distant third, chemical. And there are a number of things I would even put in front of chemical that aren't WMD, so to speak, but that I think are a more significant threat. In terms of why, nuclear, you know, in a sense, we haven't heard much about nuclear weapons for the last 30 years. There's this, I mean, everyone knows they're still out there. But there's this sense that when the Cold War ended, the world ducked, you know, the sort of nuclear Holocaust bullet. And the focus has really been on the emergence of small regional nuclear powers like North Korea and Iran. And that's a very serious issue, but it's not an existential issue. The fact of the matter is that nuclear weapons are really returning to the central role that they played in the Cold War, but now in this new emerging world order we see of multipolar competition centering on the U.S., Russia, and China. So I would say that in terms of the threat to the nation and indeed to humanity that nuclear weapons pose, they are higher now and growing more than not only in our lifetimes, but I would say since the dawn of the nuclear age. Biological has always been ignored to a certain extent. And I think the pandemic may be finally awakening people to the threat that biological weapons can hold. Again, the threat of biological weapons has been there, since the Middle Ages, when people, were tossing plague-infected bodies into siege cities. However, this threat really is also poised in a place where it could become much, much more serious, a risk. And there's a lot of unknowns. And that's because of the revolution in biotechnology and biosciences. And so, we now face the prospect of biological weapons that could conceivably be targeted to certain genetic features and whatnot. So that's just a whole new world. And as we think about the promise that biotechnology holds in terms of medical breakthroughs and whatnot, unfortunately, for every medical breakthrough, for every development of medicine, there's a dark side to that. And those developments offer the prospect using them for nefarious purposes. And then chemical weapons are serious, but they're essentially a battlefield weapon. They're horrific weapons, but I would put the potential of cyber and the destructive power of cyber certainly ahead of chemical and any number of other things.
Yeah, I think you and I are pretty much in total agreement there. A massive nuclear exchange is certainly not anything that we want to have happen anywhere in the world. I would tell you, just from my perspective, the one that has always terrified me is the weaponized biological threat. Especially, as you just mentioned, the advancing sciences that we have today in this area, it could be really, really bad. I mean, if you think about it, we just hit the 800,000 mark on deaths in America from COVID, and the mortality rate on COVID is pretty low compared to what some of the naturally occurring viruses deliver out there in the world, like Ebola as an example, or smallpox, if that ever made a weaponized entry back into humanity. So, David, a few weeks ago, I had three former students of mine on the show. They had all majored in international relations for their undergraduate degree, and all three of them had already earned or are now earning a master's degree in something linked to international relations. You've been a scholar practitioner in national security. What advice would you give to high school and college students who think this field of study and the nexus of international relations and American national security is what they want to pursue for their career? How do smart, talented young people break into these fields with the U.S. government or even with think tanks? What's the path to success today?
So that's a great question, and I will tell you it is a tough field to break into. So anyone contemplating that should sort of understand that going in. I was one of those people. I decided this is what I wanted to do when I was 15 years old. And sort of pursued it relentlessly. Your students, your former students are doing exactly the right thing. The feeder system into this, whether you want to go into think tanks or become a congressional staffer or try to break into the federal bureaucracy and the national security system, the feeder system is a professional master's degree from one of the top schools of international relations, professional schools of international relations. So those are schools like the Kennedy School at Harvard, the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins, my own alma mater in this regard, the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, School of International Service at American University. If you'll notice, most of these are clustered around Washington,
DC,
and there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
What I would say is you really want to go to a top school if you are going into this area. There are a lot of secondary and even tertiary master's degree programs like this. But to be honest, the competition coming out of these programs, this is just one of these situations where, unfortunately, it's a funnel with a very wide opening in terms of input and a very narrow opening in terms of output. So the competition for the jobs that everyone from these programs wants, it's such that you really want to be at one of the top schools. And I would say one of the top schools in Washington so that you can be doing internships and making those contacts even while you're while you're studying. Columbia is great if you want to go into something related to international business. Columbia would be your best because for the exact same reason in New York City and that proximity. Kennedy School, you know, you're at a disadvantage, but it's also Harvard, so yeah. You're not really at a disadvantage. But my advice would be focus on getting into one of those top schools, but do it with your eyes wide open. It is tough to break into this, and unfortunately, one of the things that makes it even tougher is at the end you'll have a degree that if you don't break into it isn't very dynamic in terms of being useful for other things. It's not like if you had a law degree or something like that, you didn't get to do exactly what you want. Well, you can do any number of other things. With a degree in international affairs or public policy or something like that, so you are taking a big risk. But if that's what you want to do, that's the path to do it.
Yeah, if it's your passion, it doesn't feel like work, right?
Exactly.
So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, and we're broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. David Cooper from the U.S. Naval War College, and we're discussing nuclear deterrence and disarmament in the age of advancing technology. And so, Dr. Cooper, let's dive into our core topic for today, nuclear deterrence and disarmament. And I think we should begin our talk by covering the state of play in the world with regard to nuclear weapons. There are a number of countries out there that do have a nuclear inventory. Thankfully, only a few of those potentially threaten American national security interests. And those countries are Russia, China, and North Korea, and maybe Iran eventually. But I want to add that if the Pakistani Taliban happened to overthrow the Pakistani government, the nation of Pakistan could immediately join that list of potential threats to America. And I say that only because the Taliban in Afghanistan created a blueprint for success. So we should be mindful of Pakistan's stability as we go forward. Could you talk a little bit about Russia first? What advancements are the Russians making in their arsenal or their delivery capabilities, and why should we be concerned?
Well, let me start out by saying that Russia is now far and away the number one nuclear power in the world. In terms of number of nuclear weapons, they are far ahead of us, who right now are number two. But also in terms of modernization, they are coming to the end of a cycle that Vladimir Putin launched about a decade ago to fully modernize their nuclear triad. We are just at the beginning stages of modernization. So at this point, the Russians have a far larger force, but they also have a far more capable force. Our nuclear forces at this point are, frankly, for the most part, decrepit. This is why we are modernizing all three legs of our nuclear triad simultaneously, because we have not modernized since the end of the Cold War. We basically went on a nuclear modernization holiday for the last 30 years, yeah. Whereas Russia did not. So in that sense, you can only describe the Russian strategic posture as formidable. Now, there are various questions in terms of, is it sustainable?
Right.
Russia's economic situation, certainly, if I had to choose our economy or the Russian economy, I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep agonizing over that choice. So it may well be that Russia is at its high water mark, but that is not necessarily a reassuring thing. Because President Putin, I think, may realize that. And really, nuclear forces and strategic advantage is really the only thing Russia has going for it in terms of Putin's bid to return Russia to being a premier global power. And so Russia relies on its strategic forces more than most countries as sort of a basis of its military power. In terms of specifics...
So David, if I can ask very quickly on that topic. I've had a lot of conversations with people who are, you know, former or retired even national security professionals, and we all sort of come to the same conclusion that, frankly, if Russia did not have the size nuclear arsenal that they have today, nobody would pay any attention to them. They'd be virtually irrelevant on a global scale. Is that a pretty accurate?
I mean, somewhere between irrelevant and, you know, Brazil.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough.
But the fact is, they do have, and when you look at the size of the Russian economy, the investment that they have put in, I mean, this is a sizable investment. And again, they're at the return end of that investment. So currently coming online, just to give you a few snippets, you have the Satan II, the Sarmat, heavy ICBM. This will be the largest ICBM ever produced. It is capable, and this is official Russian TV, loves the statistic. It is a single Sarmat Satan II missile will be capable of carrying enough MIRVs, multiple independently retargetable vehicles, to destroy the entire state of Texas or the entire nation of France. In other words, one missile will be able to carry enough firepower to pretty much obliterate Texas. They are deploying these over the next few years, and that will be a mainstay of their missile force. The Poseidon, nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed, autonomous torpedo. This is essentially Putin's answer to his concerns about American missile defense efforts. If you're worried America is going to develop missile defenses that might obviate your missiles, well, you create an underwater missile. This has been nicknamed the Tsunami Apocalypse Torpedo. It's a very interesting strategic concept. This is, if you remember Dr. Strangelove, this is the actual doomsday machine. In fact, these things are basically designed to carry larger nuclear warheads than have ever been deployed by a very large factor. And the operational concept is they are going to, in custom designed submarines, they are going to loiter off our coasts. And if and when they're deployed, their deployment method will be to create a huge radioactive tsunami, which will inundate basically the seacoasts of the United States where most of our population lives. So again, this is getting back to the idea. This is the true doomsday scenario. Russia is also ahead in the development of the newest delivery technology, maneuverable hypersonic missiles. And unlike the United States, Russia has been explicit that it is developing these as nuclear delivery vehicles to include intercontinental strategic nuclear delivery vehicles. And Russia is thought to be planning to have multiple of these maneuverable hypersonic missiles launched again off of that Satan II Sarmat missile. So these are technologies that are as game changing, I believe, over the coming decade as the development of ICBMs and MIRVs were in the 1960s. So we are moving into a game-changing technology race. And at this point, we are certainly, I think, as a government and as a nation, waking up to that fact. But we are, in my assessment, behind the curve. Both Russia and China have a bit of a head start on this stuff.
Now on the Russian inventory, those new ICBMs, are those mobile platforms carried around on transporter erector launchers or TELs, or are they silo based like a lot of our nuclear force and what China's working towards? And I ask that question because those offer two very different challenges from a targeting perspective, right?
Yep, it's a great question. So the Sarmat will be silo-based, but Russia does have mobile missiles, and China is developing a mobile ICBM, which will have MIRVs. And this is another point. We not only are behind in numbers, we have no mobile systems at all, and we're about to replace the Minuteman, but we're replacing it with another static silo-based. The last time we thought about replacing the Minuteman in the late Cold War period, no one thought about replacing them with another static silo-based system. That was literally not even an option. There were two systems that were debated, the so-called Midgetman mobile ICBM.
I remember that.
And the MX Peacekeeper, which was going to be a heavy rail mobile ICBM. And in the end, before the Cold War ended, the decision that was made was to go with both of those and to move to an all mobile ICBM force. So the fact that we are basically going to be investing our treasure to buy a new static ICBM, it's a product of that decision was made in, basically the early Obama administration at a time when we weren't really thinking about active strategic competition. My assessment is it's too late to change that. The idea of going back to the drawing board at this point is politically probably not sustainable. But from a strategic point of view, and again, this is where I say all positions are my own.
Yeah, yeah.
From a strategic point of view, it's nonsensical. We should be replacing our static ICBMs with at least some mobile ICBMs as we were planning to during the Cold War. That's just not how it's shaping up.
Yeah. Maybe we should move on to China. We only have about a half hour left, unfortunately. A lot of our listeners, I'm sure, have heard the recent news about China's development of ICBM missile fields in western China, hundreds of new silos. The Chinese are building much greater nuclear deterrence capacity for themselves. They've also been working on new delivery capabilities. So can you explain what the Chinese are doing and why?
Well, that is currently the big debate.
Yep.
within the field. So, there are different theories of the case, ranging from the relatively benign that China, as we are entering a period of strategic competition, that China feels that it can no longer lag so far behind the United States as it has. And so this kind of benign view is that China is moving to basically achieve enough of a credible deterrent against the United States that the United States can't use its overwhelming nuclear superiority as a way of bullying or intimidating China. So that's sort of the benign interpretation. Another interpretation, one I personally subscribe to, is that what we are seeing here is essentially a sprint towards strategic parity, that China, having mastered the technology, they are fielding a full-scope MIRV ICBM, mobile ICBM, for the first time. They are fielding capable submarine-launched intercontinental submarine-launched ballistic missiles for the first time. So that theory is essentially that they mastered the technology while keeping the numbers low. Now that they have that technology, they are going to do a sprint towards parity. And then a third theory of the case is actually the same as that, but with a little more sinister edge, and that is that this is a sprint towards superiority. And particularly given that China and Russia, they are still nuclear rivals. They are still targeting each other. But of course, politically, they have at least a temporary marriage of convenience designed to basically put the United States on its heels in terms of being the dominant global power. So in that sense, the idea is that China may even be wanting to get the sort of nuclear superiority that would let it intimidate us. So that scenario goes something like, hey, we're about to invade Taiwan, and lest you think you want to intervene on that, remember, we now have as many or more nuclear weapons as you do. And that reflects, we've seen this, with Ukraine. President Putin has used nuclear saber rattling pretty consistently, where he will publicly remind people who think that maybe they want to intervene that Russia is the largest nuclear power in the world. So in terms of which of those it is, that's sort of the explanation of, what their intentions are. And that's hard to know. What they're doing, though, is pretty obvious. And that is that they are significantly bolstering from a small, presumed small strategic nuclear force to a much larger one. I would also point out they are ahead of us, too, and maybe ahead of the Russians in developing intercontinental hypersonic maneuverable delivery vehicles. And another news story that surprised many in the media and the public, but wasn't a surprise to those of us who follow these issues, was basically their globe-circling hypersonic missile. That's what it was presumed to be, which essentially would be able to hit any target on Earth very rapidly and overcome any defenses and even current detection systems that we now have.
Yeah, it's a little disconcerting. You know, I was going to ask you, as you were talking about, you know, the three reasons why you think China might be doing what they're doing, and you beat me to the punch because I was going to ask you, do you think they took a lesson from watching Putin play one of the weakest hands out there? But because he has such a strong nuclear deterrent, he can get away with a lot more than any other country. So if China does have that same capability on parity with the United States, they have a lot more juice to work with, as we say, right? Let's talk a little bit about North Korea. I want to get into the North Korea problem, and then maybe we can talk about Iran as well. How many warheads does North Korea have? How powerful are those warheads? What capabilities do they possess to deliver those warheads against American targets? And I'll ask this question because I think it's something that people should know. What are America's defenses specifically against a North Korean strike against the United States?
So that's another big debate. In terms of your most basic question, the number of warheads is obviously not known, but the typical unclassified estimate is that they probably have about 50 at this point, give or take. The real question is about delivery and whether those 50 warheads are actually deliverable in a way that could threaten the United States or even our much closer allies, such as Japan and South Korea, obviously. Yeah. So they have a challenge in terms of warheads, and that is, it's one thing to build a nuclear warhead, meaning you've built something that in a test explodes and produces a nuclear explosion at a significant yield. It's another to have that miniaturized and toughened up enough, if you will, to be able to be delivered on top of a ballistic missile. And given that the North Koreans have no long-range bomber capabilities per se, ballistic missiles are their only real option. So that's the first unknown. They are thought to be making progress in that direction, but it's unknown how much progress. And then there's the missiles themselves.
If I could ask, David, they have not yet demonstrated the full cycle of delivery of a warhead from an ICBM and detonation at the end of that targeting, right?
They have not. They claim to have an ICBM. Yeah. And they've done some testing that has surprised people because it's actually looking a lot better than people thought. But it is not certain that they even have an ICBM yet. So they've got a warhead challenge and they've got a missile challenge. They need to develop a warhead that can be delivered by an ICBM, and then they need to develop that ICBM. And so far, it's not clear that they have either. But what is clear is they are working very hard on both sides of that puzzle. And there are some worrying indications that they are making progress. In terms of South Korea and Japan, that does not require, obviously, an ICBM. And it's far more likely that when and if they get a warhead that is capable of being delivered on a ballistic missile, that they will have the ballistic missiles ready that can threaten our regional allies and regional forces.
And how about American defenses against a North Korean strike? I mean, when we talk about like a Russia or China strike on the U.S., that's an overwhelming strike. It's a very almost impossible defense against that. But a country like North Korea with a limited number of warheads, a limited number of ICBMs, if they ever develop it, what's our capacity to knock those things down?
So in a sense, that has been the pacing threat for our defensive programs for the last 20 years. And, you know, China and Russia have consistently kind of gone bonkers about our missile defense stuff. And we have consistently said, look, we need to be able to defend ourselves against a limited threat like North Korea. we're not so sure that deterrence is going to be what we want to rely on. And you need to understand that Russia and China haven't understood that. They are convinced that that is just a stalking horse to, you know, sort of develop new technologies. But for North Korea, that's the threat that we have been facing. We do have a limited capability in terms of national missile defense, which is aimed at a North Korean style threat. Guam, Hawaii are thought to be obvious targets. We are working very closely and cooperatively with Japan as Japan develops missile defenses. So that part of it, I think, is well in hand, even if there's still work to be done. The problem is if this hypersonic genie gets out of the bottle and North Korea is already starting to make noises that, yep, we're going to get into that hypersonic business. As a matter of fact, they claim to already be in it. That changes everything because right now we don't have defenses against maneuverable hypersonic vehicles for all intents and purposes. For technical reasons, I won't get into what works against a ballistic missile is very unlikely to be effective against a maneuverable hypersonic vehicle. And so we may have to go back to the drawing board and come up with an entirely new concept of missile defense, not only because of Russia and China, but even for threats like North Korea, Iran, or others, if, as I say, this hypersonic missile genie gets out of the bottle. And that will basically involve a space-based defensive architecture, which again is an entirely new kettle of fish to anything that we have now or have been pursuing.
So we almost go back to the era of Ronald Reagan and SDI.
we do. I mean, essentially, if you have the deployment of maneuverable hypersonic nuclear delivery vehicles, you really have to go back to almost the Reagan concept. And indeed, there are some experts who are suggesting that the most efficient thing we could do right now is dust off what was called Brilliant Pebbles,
right? Yeah.
Which was the scaled back version of SDI,
yeah.
That was canceled when the Cold War ended. And basically, the idea there is, look, we have the blueprints; they're 30 years old, yeah. but let's open that drawer, pull them out, and start thinking about pursuing that sort of thing.
Yeah. So hitting a bullet with another bullet, right? That's kind of where our defense concepts stand right now. What about directed energy weapons as a defense against maneuverable hypersonics? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, it's a possibility, and it's certainly one that everyone is looking at. Defensive energy in terms of missile defense, whether ground-based or space-based, is another possibility. That's exactly, I mean, the Reagan Strategic Defense Initiative was rather derisively referred to as Star Wars at the time.
Right.
In effect, hypersonics will require Star Wars concepts. We have miraculously achieved the ability to hit a moving bullet with a moving bullet, which everyone thought could be impossible. Well, we've done that. Now we have a maneuvering moving bullet.
Right.
the challenge there, a maneuvering moving bullet with almost no heat signature.
Right. Yep.
So right now we use infrared as our main tracking. That will not track a hypersonic during portions of its flight, and it's maneuvering, and it's coming in at hypersonic speeds.
Yeah. Let's move on to the Iranian program. I'd like to talk about that just a little bit, and then there's some other questions I want to make sure we cover today. Where does the Iranian program stand right now? No warheads yet, but the potential to break out. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it stands right now not too far from where it stood in 2015 when the nuclear deal went into effect. I mean, in a sense, the Iran nuclear deal called JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it wasn't really a disarmament agreement. It was more of pause. I mean, it basically was seeking to freeze the Iranian program in place in the hopes that you could freeze it for a decade and, you know, work the matter politically. The fact of the matter is that Iran is sort of in a partial unfreezing. When the Trump administration withdrew, Iran has been sort of progressively violating aspects of the nuclear deal, but they are still negotiating a return to the deal. At this point, though, even if miraculously Iran said, okay, we'll return to the deal tomorrow, the fact is that that pause has so little time left. So essentially, Iran is right where they were. They are poised kind of at the threshold of things and will either break out of JCPOA or allow it to expire. And in some ways, and I hate to say this, but in some ways, the nuclear deal made things worse because it unfroze, a huge amount of assets that had been frozen and lifted a number of sanctions. And so, Iran has more funding now for these programs than it had before. So I don't think the Iran nuclear deal solves this. It may even have made things slightly worse, but we are where we are. The Biden administration is pursuing diplomacy. It is not looking very promising. Iran, as you and your listeners know, has moved to a more hardline government at this point. So the idea that this new hardline government is going to take a softer position seems improbable. So I think, the betting money is Iran can be a nuclear power if it wants pretty quickly. Unlike North Korea, they already have all the missiles that they need. They don't have an intercontinental range, but they have the technical wherewithal that probably wouldn't be too challenging for them. So the bigger question to me is whether Iran decides to take that step or whether it kind of plays the Japanese game and tiptoes right up to the line as what's called a threshold nuclear power, where everyone knows they can become a nuclear power very quickly, but they don't cross that line, but get a lot of the coercive and whatnot benefits. In either case, the bigger question at this point isn't Iran, it's the greater Middle East.
Yeah.
And Saudi Arabia has said that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, they too will get nuclear weapons.
Right.
Turkey, which is sort of in a slow motion divorce from Europe and
and NATO.
Yeah,
exactly.
Turkey has said that they can't rule out that they would get nuclear weapons in such a situation. Israel, of course, has nuclear weapons, although that hasn't been officially confirmed. Israel could easily respond to this by coming out of the closet and declaring itself a nuclear power, possibly even testing. And then it's not inconceivable in that sort of situation that Egypt might decide they need to join the fracas. So it is very worrisome that Iran could be a nuclear power, but in a sense, that's just the beginning of the worry. The worry is if and when that happens, what will the regional dynamics be? And frankly, all of that is more worrisome because of the power vacuum in the perceived post-Afghanistan withdrawal fiasco, in the perceived power vacuum that the U.S. has left. Now, obviously, we're going to try to reverse that perception, but whether the greater Middle East in terms of a nuclear arms race at the regional level, I think is very much an open question.
So I was going to ask you, should we be more worried about smaller states and nuclear proliferations or the larger states with truly significant nuclear weapons inventory or both? I think you've kind of answered that question as we've gone through this discussion. Let me ask you this. Dr. Cooper, all this sounds like we might be entering into a destabilizing phase with regard to nuclear weapons. New delivery capabilities that render many of the ballistic missile defenses inadequate or even obsolete. And I suspect you might have some ideas on how these capabilities undermine current treaties or other defenses. Could you share your thoughts on those two points, especially the treaties? How do these new capabilities undermine the existing treaties, the few that are left anyway?
Yep. So I have a new book that just came out called Arms Control for the Third Nuclear Age Between Disarmament and Armageddon. And the key part of that title is the third nuclear age. And my suggestion is that the world is entering a third nuclear age. The first nuclear age was the Cold War, and that was the bilateral, bipolar standoff between the two superpowers. The second nuclear age was the post-Cold War era, where essentially you had U.S. dominance at the conventional level, and nuclear weapons sort of receded. And certainly in terms of U.S.-Russia, that just wasn't, it wasn't something anyone was worried about. So we were worried about the lesser things like Iraq or Iran or Syria or whatnot. The third nuclear age that I think is emerging, many people think is emerging, is basically going to be a multipolar situation where you have nuclear competition between a core triangle of Russia, the United States, and China, where each of those three is targeting each of the other two. In addition, you'll have France and Britain targeting Russia. You have India targeting China. So this is all a very destabilizing web of relationships. And that's even assuming that you don't have new powers jumping in. For the first time in decades, you have serious discussions, although quiet and unofficial discussions, about whether some of our allies think they may need their own nuclear weapons. So these are discussions in places like Japan, Australia, South Korea, Germany. But even assuming you don't have new powers jumping in, my argument is that the world has never known a multipolar nuclear standoff.
Right.
And if you think about it, our whole concept of deterrence, the great strategist, Lawrence Friedman, one of the last living great nuclear strategists from the Cold War, depicted deterrence in the image of a Western and, you know, the standoff between the two guys, each of them holding their guns. And, you know, the idea is if they both knew the other might be able to get them, neither would draw, that it was a standoff. I argue that what we're coming into is another Western image.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
It's the Mexican standoff. Exactly. Yeah. It's where everyone has people on all sides and they're all shifting. Yeah. And if you just think about that, the chances of that going wrong are much worse because any one person that miscalculates and everyone's shooting everyone.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a situation where, you know, you have one actor gets antsy and does something, even just in terms of raising nuclear alert postures or whatever. And it's going to be a ripple effect across this web because everyone else is going to respond to that. And this is something that, frankly, we don't even have a theory of deterrence for yet, because our theories of deterrence are from the bipolar Cold War world. And then in the post-Cold War world, well, we thought deterrence didn't matter.
Yeah.
And we stopped thinking about it. I'm exaggerating to a bit, but to a certain extent, in terms of strategic nuclear deterrence, not so much. In this world, this is where the smaller countries can be real problems too, because again, imagine who's the country you'd be most worried. Is that Russia? Is that China? Is that India? No, that's probably North Korea, potentially Iran. But here's the thing. If North Korea does something crazy and stupid, we react to North Korea, but then China and Russia react to us and that whole web gets activated again.
Right.
So the danger of the small countries in this interconnected web of nuclear dyads, if you will, is they could be not that North Korea is going to be a threat in itself to American civilization or the world, but it could be the spark. It could be, if you will, the assassination in Sarajevo.
I was just thinking the same thing. It looks like World War One all over again.
Exactly.
So Dr. Cooper, let's talk a little bit. We only have about 10 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about how we pull the world back from the brink. With your experience at OSD, how does the U.S. initiate a dialogue with countries like Russia, China, and North Korea to start the process of creating and adopting maybe some new treaties relevant to our modern geopolitical realities? And I'll ask you, you know, what would a new treaty look like? Does it control the total number of warheads? Does it control delivery capabilities, numbers of silos or launchers, how many missiles a nation has? Because that's separate and distinct from the number of warheads. How many aircraft or ballistic missile submarines? I mean, what are the operative ways to control for, you know, to increase safety?
Yep. So this is the topic of the book I mentioned that I just published, Arms Control for the Third Nuclear Age, is looking specifically at that question. And what I come out with is a fairly pessimistic, but nonetheless, so the current nuclear control architecture is unraveling. It's in tatters. And that makes sense. It was never designed for great power strategic rivalry. It was designed for much more benign conditions. So the question is, do we move into the first uncontrolled arms race since 1972, or can we put some nuclear guardrails in place? I think the prospects for putting nuclear guardrails in place are very dim in the near term, and that we need to look at the long game here. And the reason for that is that right now, Russia and China really don't have a lot of motivation.
Yeah.
Russia is in the catbird seat and China is in an inferior position now that they clearly have decided to rectify. So the idea that either of them would agree to negotiating their way out of that advantageous position is in my view, far-fetched. I think what we need to be thinking of is in terms of we need to, and this is going to be a very controversial thought, but I will put it out there. We need to get back to the Cold War concept of arms racing toward arms control. Mm. In other words, we need to make it clear that if they are going to try to be achieving an advantage over us, that we will not allow that, that we will develop systems and deploy systems and whatnot, all while saying, but there's another way. There's a better way. Yeah. There's a less costly way. There's a less dangerous way. And this is, in fact, how arms control worked. I mean, remember, the START Treaty, the INF Treaty, these were the product of basically a quarter century of negotiations throughout which there was an arms race and throughout which the Soviets continually tried to test, whether they could get an advantage. Right now, if we want arms control, we are going to have to show that we are willing to arms race as an alternative. If we're not, then essentially we're engaging in unilateral disarmament. Because if we stay still while others move forward, that is, in effect, unilateral disarmament. And if you're unilaterally disarming, rivals are going to, when you say, how about having a treaty, are going to say, no, we're fine letting you do that. That is a tough pill to swallow. Right now, the two solutions that are out there, you have doves that want kind of universal disarmament, and you have hawks who want to throw off the shackles of these Cold War treaties and post-Cold War treaties and try to compete in an unfettered way. My view is neither of those solutions is viable. You're not going to get nuclear disarmament because China and Russia are profoundly disinterested. And I don't believe we can arms race to superiority, certainly against China at this point, just because of our own domestic political and budgetary constraints. So my personal view is what we need to do is get back to a Cold War style of mentality. And that is that we are an arms race. We need to acknowledge that in a clear-eyed way. We need to engage in it, but we need to do that always offering proposals for an alternative along the lines of strategic nuclear treaties.
And I'm assuming any new treaties that we want to move forward with is going to have that trust but verify component to it. So there's a mechanism to confirm the other sides are doing what they say they're going to do.
It is. And that's going to be one of the huge obstacles because the Chinese are absolutely anathema to any kind of transparency. China has a fundamentally different theory of deterrence than the United States and Russia. Both the United States and Russia have a theory of deterrence that basically says the way to deter is by making clear how strong you are.
Yeah.
We want everyone to know what we have and what it can do. The Chinese have a theory of deterrence that basically says being ambiguous, being opaque, keeping the others guessing about how strong you are is a theory of deterrence. And therefore, for them, verification is absolutely anathema. So, I think if we're going to have any progress, it's probably going to look a lot more like the SALT I treaty in the early 70s, which essentially was not having any intrusive verification, and therefore was only trying to limit really huge things like missile silos, number of missile silos, number of submarines, not warheads or even missiles themselves. To be honest, though, I think all of those technical details are beside the point for now. Right now, we need to focus on motivating China to belly up to the bar in terms of even being willing to join a negotiating process, and that hasn't happened yet. So in a sense, we really are in the baby step phase. There's no point trying to come up with, well, here's the big treaty that solves everything. We have to get the Chinese to be willing to come and join the United States and Russia at that negotiating table.
Yeah. Dr. Cooper, we're almost out of time. Give us the title of the book, your recent book, one more time.
The book is Arms Control for the Third Nuclear Age: Between Disarmament and Armageddon. And it was published in October by Georgetown University Press.
And it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
It is available on Amazon.
All right. Well, sir, we've come to the end of another edition of National Security This Week. Dr. David Cooper, thank you so much for joining us. You've helped us to further understand both nuclear deterrence and disarmament challenges, a subject we've been looking at throughout this first year of our time on the air with this show. Thank you so much for joining us.
John, thanks for having me. It was really a pleasure.
And how much longer do you have left on the term this fall at Naval War College?
So we are in our winter term. We're actually in a trimester system. So Okay. Our winter term runs basically from November through February.
Okay. A little time off over the holidays, I assume.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
All right. So, folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. We would love your feedback on National Security This Week here at KYMN Radio, so please take a few minutes to contact us and let us know how we're doing. Have a fantastic finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.